welcome everyone today to our panel focused on tariffs, trade, and Trump. We'll also touch a little bit on the subject of reshoring. This panel is sponsored by Tama ETFs, who manage the American Reshoring ETF ticker, RSHO. You can check them out. We'll also get a link pinned up here to the top to learn more directly from Tama, including state-by-state initiatives in reshoring. Now, those of you who have attended our spaces in the past know I like to keep them wide open for discussion. I know we have a lot of new speakers today that we haven't had in the past. So, new panelists, please feel free to chime in when you've got something more to add. The only request that I have is that we keep all of our microphones muted when other speakers are talking, so we don't have any overlap or audio feedback. Now, as we will be discussing individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different. So you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully so that it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this space should be construed as financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or derivative. Always conduct your own research or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. Now, with all of that said and out of the way, let's start off with our introductions. First up, we've got the man himself, Yuri Kojamirian, the CIO of Tama ETFs, today's sponsor. He has over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios, and he co-managed the Magity Fund, raising several billions of dollars in assets. And in our previous panels, I've been loving Yuri's insight because he's been very helpful, really good from an investor's point of view as well. So thanks for coming and sponsoring this panel, as always, Yuri.
Forward to the discussion.
As am I. Next, we've got Boris Kovacevic. Boris is a global macro strategist at Convera, preparing daily and weekly preparations of market, currency, and economic reports. His work has been cited in Bloomberg, Reuters, and CNBC. Boris is a highly regarded chartist as well, and his charts have appeared all across media, and I'm excited to have his experience here with us today. Welcome, Boris.
Well, good morning, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be part of such an amazing panel, so looking forward to the discussion.
Up next, we've got Brent Johnson from Santiago Capital. He has over 20 years experience in the financial markets, ranging from managing director at Baker Avenue Asset Management to CEO of Santiago Capital, managing hundreds of millions in assets. Brent frequently does interviews and speaks at conferences on a wide array of topics, from metals to macro econ and currencies. And I'm really happy to have him here today with us. Welcome, Brent.
Thanks for having me. This should be a good discussion.
Up next, we've got Adam Ozimek, the Chief Economist at Economic Innovation Group, serving on the executive team and leading an ever-growing font of research. He's also served as Chief Economist at Upwork and Senior Economist at Moody's, and his research has been cited nearly everywhere, from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times. Thanks for joining us today, Adam. Excited to hear your thoughts.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Excited to be here as an economist among a bunch of finance guys. Don't worry, I don't believe in the efficient market hypothesis, so we should be able to have fun.
Oh, man, could have had a little bit of strife going on there, a little butting of heads. Thanks for coming, Adam. Next, we've got Andy Constant. Over three decades of investment in global markets experience, honing his expertise in macro investing. He's worked as idea generator at Bridgewater and chief strategist at Brevan Howard. And he also started two funds specializing in multi-asset volatility and capital structure arbitrage, and currently is the founder, CEO, and chief investment officer of Damped Spring Advisors. His expertise is a great addition to today's panel. Welcome, Andy.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And our final panelist, certainly not the least, is Jens Nordvig, a former managing director at Goldman Sachs and Bridgewater Associates. He's also served as head of fixed income research and global currency strategy at Nomura Securities. In 2016, Jens founded Exante Data, a company focused on in-depth macro thematic research, capital flow analysis, and investment and trading strategy for investors all over the world. This company drew very early support from Trump's recent Treasury pick, Scott Bessent, and now serves investors the world over. Very excited to have your input today, Jens. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody, with all of that out of the way, our esteemed panelists here to give us some background. The topic of incoming Trump administration's tariff plans has really sparked debate, controversy, what have you, on both sides of the aisle, a lot of it carrying some negative connotations. On our last tariff-related panel, we focused a lot on reshoring, which we will touch on during this one as well. But I wanted to start off by looking at some of the arguments we touched on last time, as well as some of those we weren't able to get to. So to get us rolling here, Yuri, right out of the gate, how might the proposed tariffs incentivize reshoring of manufacturing jobs to the United States, and which industries are most likely to benefit? What are the TAMA folks managing the American reshoring ETF looking at?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's an interesting situation we find ourselves in. I think what's happened is we've got a Trump administration now for sure, which is quite new. And all we have to go by is kind of the rhetoric and some of the statements that have been made since then. But I think if you take them in their totality, Trump's policies are very much going to be focused over the next 4 years on supporting US manufacturing, rebuilding the US manufacturing base. They're going to be very different in their nature to the Biden-Harris administration, under which there was the passage of the major acts like the IIJA and IRA and the CHIPS Act, which subsidized a lot of domestic manufacturing. Here, the policy of choice is going to be using tariffs. There's also going to be a use of selective tariffs in a way of protecting domestic industry. But broadly, the actual rhetoric is focused on universal tariffs. So this idea that the US is the biggest consumer market in the world, but yet has consistently ceded market share globally of manufacturing, that if you look at any statistic, really, the most stark one is industrial production growth, which pretty much since the entry of China into WTO has flatlined or has been quite cyclical and bounced around, whereas consumption and GDP growth have continued to grow over this period. And I guess the policies are all aimed at saying, well, if you want access to this large consumer market, which is the demand engine of the world, you're probably going to need to either pay for it or there needs to be more share given to US domestic businesses. And what we're hearing on the ground from companies is there's a lot of sort of excitement, although uncertain what actual policies are going to look like, how they're going to get implemented, when, etc. But in general, the businesses that we talk to are the ones that are going to benefit a lot from more industrial production in the US and the rebuilding of US manufacturing. If you look at statistics of construction spending on manufacturing, it's gone parabolic, it's booming. A lot of that is consumer electronics and chips and future-proofed industries. So what we think is broadly the Trump administration is kind of very, very positive for the reshoring space and has given it a big shot in the arms, in the arm. And that has been really something that has also already been going on under the surface for a long time, but pushed along by these major government acts. So we think this will be positive for US industries. They will be shielded in a way from the foreign competition, but really just incentivize more and more to rebuild and move manufacturing to the US. And that's what we think will happen over the next couple of years.
And so I know when we last spoke about this, Yuri, there was a lot of discussion as well about general market volatility just based on the what ifs surrounding the election. Do you think that volatility is mostly subsided now that we have that for sure Trump administration?
Yeah, I think, look, it's elections always lead to some sort of short-term volatility. I think the result was a little bit of a surprise for markets, although not quite, because prediction markets were there already. I think if you look at the reaction and the share prices of some of the companies in the reshoring space, have been very positive. Generally, industrial companies and companies focused on reshoring have gone up on the Trump result. Some of that has been given back because obviously we don't know how these policies are going to look. Part of it is also the starting point, which I think is very important in investing. If you think about what was happening before, is a lot of companies we spoke to during Q3 earnings season, they were waiting for the election outcome. They were pausing investment projects. They wanted to have a bit more clarity of what will happen. And I think as that clarity has come in with the election result, we've resolved one of the issues. The next is going to be, what are the policies going to look like? But I think if you're an executive and certainly the ones we speak to, in a firm thinking about where you're going to move manufacturing capacity, is probably going to be to the US. And that decision is quite clear under a Trump administration over the next 4 years. So that volatility subsided and has priced up, but it's as a lot of these things are, and you see it historically, they kind of are just the beginning. Initially, the market's trying to figure this out. Either this is going to be a big thing, which will be a driver of markets for the next year or even further, especially in the reshoring space.
Thank you, Yuri. So to kind of touch a little bit on the domestic production aspect of tariffs, Andy, I'd love your take here as well. Could those increased tariffs stimulate domestic production as stated by Trump's team? And how might tariffs affect U.S. economic growth, which has kind of been pretty solid in recent times?
Yeah, I guess I would look at the situation today as being very uncertain. And it's a question that when I think about tariffs, I think about them in two ways. One is it policy, meaning are there going to be meaningful tariffs that persist, or is it threat? And we'll start with I'll start with the idea of policy. So I think Michael Pettis has been writing out some very nice notes about this, and it's completely consistent with the way I think about tariffs, in that tariffs basically take whatever the GDP share is and reallocate it from domestic consumption to domestic production. And so the question about, and so it doesn't really have a impact on the GDP. It has an impact on whether on consumption versus production. So it's a share of GDP issue. It could lead to either GDP growing or shrinking, depending on how that works. So for instance, and Michael used this example, if the tariffs were on coffee, where we have no ability to make coffee, all that would happen is GDP would fall, and because domestic consumption would fall. And so that's not a good outcome. So we really have to be quite cautious about what exactly those policy tariffs are to see whether it will be additive to the GDP or negative to the GDP, because we do know that it will shift the share from consumption to production. And the tariffs are unclear in terms of what exactly is going to be targeted. I do agree with the sentiment that the Trump administration is pro-growth. I honestly have never seen an administration that's anti-growth. And there's a question about whether tariffs will be pro-growth or not. Now, the other thing about tariffs is they lead to retaliatory tariffs, which reverses that dynamic. It once again favors domestic consumption over production because it reverses the impact of the tariffs. But what I think is going to happen in the near term is that the trade negotiations are a form of friction, and that friction will be negative to growth. How long it'll last, what impact it has on currency, will depend on how the negotiation works, and the frictions, and which will cause both a positive to inflation and a negative to growth, will be spread broadly over both the export country and the U.S. via currency. So then we look at domestic equities. And domestic equities, you know, one would favor, presuming it gets done the way we think, which is additive to GDP and a one-time price increase, one would want to favor pure exporters over pure importers. And, you know, that may or may not be already priced. Certainly, we don't know enough to determine whether what industries are going to be directly impacted by what tariffs against what country. One thing I would say is that the central bank probably shouldn't care much about this unless these frictions are catalysts for some otherwise negative or positive event regarding the GDP or inflation. If they're just what they are, the central bank should expect, again, a one-time price change for domestic prices that is softened by currency changes. So that's how I think about tariffs as a policy. But it's not clear to me that the policy is to have large, persistent tariffs, but is in fact being used as a threat. And when you think about threat, the implications on the economy, which I'll pause before I hit and let somebody else speak, could be things like used to manage immigration, like what we saw already with the threatened 25% tariffs across the board for Canada and Mexico. It could be used to encourage foreign domestic investment where the builders of these new factories are foreigners. It could be used to create defense spending to U.S. industry from NATO. And it also could be, and this is something that's being discussed around the periphery, it could be used to encourage people to come to the table for what is being described as a Mar-a-Lago Accord, where, similar to the Plaza Accord, an entire new phase of currency normalizations occur. And this is the stick that gets people to the table. If that were to be successful, that would have meaningful impact on the U.S.'s ability to extend duration on its deficit.
Thank you, Andy. A ton of points there, and pretty much all of which we will be getting to. So I want to open this up to the panel as a bit of a free-for-all here. Does anybody have any comments on what Andy said regarding that friction, regarding potential consequences?
Happy to comment on that. This is Jens Nordvik here. I did some meetings in Frankfurt with policymakers over the last couple of weeks, right? And actually, I would say the main concern that countries around the world have is all the uncertainty that comes out of this. If you have a 10% global tariff or a 20% global tariff, right? All the different multinational companies that have to make investment decisions, they have to kind of really think hard about, okay, what do? They don't know whether this is going to come into effect or not. And the logical thing for them to do in the short term is to delay their decision, right? So lots of policymakers around the world are certainly worried about not just the tariffs themselves, but the uncertainty that comes with them and the potential negative impact on CapEx. So I think that's a dimension that needs to be analyzed in addition to just sort of the direct impact of the tariffs.
Yeah, this is Adam. I'd like to follow up on those comments, especially Andy's comments. I had fairly strong reaction to them. I really think that it is a very incomplete oversimplification to think of tariffs as, well, we'll trade some consumption for production. Half of what we import is used by manufacturers. Okay, so that's not trading consumption for production. That's raising one producer's cost to benefit another producer. Another important fact to recognize is that our biggest exporters are our biggest importers. So when you're talking about raising tariffs, for example, on steel, and using protectionism to try to increase steel output, which, by the way, we've done for decades and it hasn't gone very well. There are 80 jobs in steel using industries for every steel producing industry. So I think sometimes there's a little bit of a desire to frame tariffs as being like kind of like tough love for the economy, or, you know, we need to make the hard decision to favor production over consumers. That's the like forward-looking pro-growth idea, but it's just really not the case. And tariffs are bad for producers. Tariffs make our exporters less globally productive. And you saw this empirically too, Trump's steel tariffs. Did they increase steel jobs? Yeah, a little bit. But we lost more jobs in steel using industries. So you have to think more carefully about this. You have to think more broadly. You should think of, in particular, what's sometimes called Factory North America. Okay, at this point, the U.S. auto industry straddles north and south borders and has production distributed across North America. And this helps it be more efficient. It helps it be more globally productive. And obviously, Europe is doing the same thing, too, putting parts of production in Eastern European countries. We are competing as a region in many ways. And so, again, this is another dimension where you can't think simplistically. Tariffs that disrupt Factory North America's ability to compete are going to reduce American manufacturers' ability to export and be globally competitive. And so this idea that tariffs give us more production, not a great way to come at this.
Thank you, Adam. Brent, I saw that you had unmuted earlier as well. Do you have some comments?
Yeah, I think the comments I would add to this, that and they somewhat echo the comments that have already been made, is that you have to kind of realize what Trump is proposing to do here is really rather revolutionary, for lack of a better word. I mean, he's talking about changing the way the United States has, you know, done business for the last 30 or 40 years. And the idea that you can have a revolution and there won't be volatility, there won't be some violence, and there won't be some spilling of blood along the way, I think would be extremely naive. So I think it's going to be a very volatile time. Having said that, I would also caution people against thinking that just because tariffs are going up and because, you know, free market economists believe tariffs are bad, that it necessarily means a disaster for the United States. I actually think in the kind of the medium to long term, this is actually a very good thing for the United States. But it doesn't mean that it's going to be a smooth ride. Even under the best circumstances, I don't think it will be a smooth ride. But I think the ability for the United States to weather, you know, the storm to come is much greater than much of the rest of the world's ability to do that. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll, you know, pass it back, is that for I've talked to a number of people who have said, you know, it's just going to automatically raise prices. No companies around the world, that they're tired of, you know, the U.S. acting as the global bully and the global hegemon, they're not going to move their manufacturing here to the United States. And I would caution people against that view. I mean, the fact is it's already happening, and it's been happening for 3, 4, 5 years. And, you know, there's multiple examples that this has already happened. So the idea that it won't happen anymore and it won't happen going forward, I think is completely wrong. I think companies around the world will move manufacturing capabilities here, and I think that will provide jobs, it will provide revenue, it will soften the blow to a certain extent.
Thank you, Brent. So we're kind of just, I want to touch a little bit more on, actually, Ben, go ahead. I see you had your hand up there.
Let me just jump in quickly on, this is on kind of Adam's point about the effects across producers. And I think something that I'm an economist, by the way. I'm kind of jumping in on the space here. I'm an economics professor who studies supply chains and some of the macro impacts of supply chain changes. And I think one issue we should maybe think on as we discuss the practical impact of this is what happened with Brexit. Why was Brexit such a big deal for the UK economy? Obviously, there are a lot of differences, but I think one thing is that the sort of regulatory frictions, uncertainty, and using these kinds of economic levers as a source of leverage, a source of bargaining power with, you know, in renegotiating business relationships. That's powerful. It can have impact. But in terms of the uncertainty, there's these effects that operate across whole supply chains. And, you know, there's a lot of externalities there that aren't well priced by the market that rely on agreements and understandings that have evolved over a long time. And so when you threaten 25% tariffs, even if you don't plan to enact them, that's going to have effects that ripple out from the immediate firms that are affected by them. And I think Brexit, the kind of, I'd say more than you would have expected, spillover and kind of multiplier effects of the Brexit uncertainty are a sort of, for me, a cautionary tale. And I think when we talk about, like, yeah, when we write down a simplistic model where we just look at some macro accounting and say, oh, it'll just shift from this to this, we should think, well, are we accounting for the real effects of the uncertainty in business relationships? Do we see businesses worrying about that? And I think that has to be, that's kind of the big real economic effect that I think is often not discussed here.
Thank you, Ben. Good points there. And I do want to touch on some things regarding the USMCA specifically here in a bit. But first, I want to touch a little bit on some of those positive connotations, some of those that Brent also mentioned. So another argument that has kind of been posited in favor of tariffs is the potential to reduce dependency on foreign supply chains, even bolster national security as a result, which does fall in line with the concept of reshoring in a lot of ways, to build domestic production in the United States, bring foreign production here domestically to lower this dependency. Boris, I'd love your insight here. What are the benefits of lessened dependency on foreign supply, and are there any negative consequences that come with that?
Yeah, pleasure to take the question. I think if we look back at Trump 1.0, when the whole trade war started with China, I think one positive externality was that indeed the US successfully, to a certain extent, decoupled itself from China. If you look at the Chinese share of US imports, it fell from 22% to 16% in a time span of around 5 to 6 years, from 2017, when the tariffs started being implemented, to around 2022. And if you look at the strategic goods, which is mainly advanced technological products, this decline was much more drastic, falling from around 37% to 23%. So if the goal of the tariffs was to get less volume dependency on China, I think it clearly worked. The decline in China's share in US imports was, of course, heavily concentrated on these tariffed goods. What we did see is that, of course, trade clears globally, not bilaterally. So while the US's share of imports from China decreased, basically other countries like Mexico, like Canada, the Eurozone, Japan, Vietnam, they all took on this extra volume that got reshored from China to these selected countries. So if you look at the diversification index, meaning the share of what the US produces versus what it imports, the diversification index basically stagnated because the nearshoring that was promised under Trump 1.0 didn't really happen. It was just that most of the imports coming from China actually got reshored to other countries, right? So again, I'm not really a fan of saying that tariffs did work under Trump 1.0, but if the main success story was to diversify itself from China, if not from the rest of the world, I think it clearly worked in the 5 years from 2017 to 2021.
Thank you, Boris. Does anybody have comments on what he said? Andy and Brent, I saw that you were unmuting there as well.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. So I have two comments. One is to your question, which is the risk and cost of reshoring, of supply chain creation that is somehow a national asset, you know, a geopolitical asset. I think the first thing one has to do is say what it is, which is if you are doing something that is causing production to occur in a higher cost part of the world, wherever it's coming from, whether it's coming through China to Vietnam to the US, or whether it's nearshoring or whether it's onshoring, if that productive capacity is excess capacity and not the cheapest capacity, its cost is insurance and its cost is inflationary. So what would be great is if we had a world that had no wars, blah, 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 and we could optimize the comparative advantage of each of the countries in the globe, and we could trade freely and not have to worry about supply chain disruptions. But onshoring is inflationary and creates productive assets that are not the best use of capital. And so that's the cost. And it's quite heavy to get, when you're fighting a war, a geopolitical war, to onshore to protect your supply chain. And I totally get why that is, but it's a insurance premium that's being paid, and it is a sunk cost for that geopolitical benefit. The second thing I'd like to just mention is Adam went into the weeds of what the economy really is, importers that are exporters, exporters that are importers, who's doing the consumption and not. The point that I've tried to make is not to say anything but the GDP is what it is. If the GDP rises, that's great. If it shrinks, that's fine. But what tariffs do is shift the share of the GDP from consumption to production. That's literally its goal. Ideally, it also achieves the other goal of an increasing GDP so that consumption doesn't, in fact, fall.
Yeah, I'd love to follow up on that. So I think it's important to understand that tariffs don't actually close the trade deficit. Trade deficit didn't go down under Trump. So if what you're talking about, the share of GDP going to production, it's just not true that you can mechanically increase this, even holding aside the impacts on GDP. It's just not true that you can mechanically increase this automatically by imposing tariffs. Others have noted, like, it's a very plausible scenario. You impose tariffs on one country, unilateral tariffs, and trade flows through other countries. We've seen this time and time again when politicians try to address trade issues with unilateral tariffs on other countries. So it's not true you just mechanically increase the production share of GDP. It's substantially more complicated than that. I also think that it's important, you know, we hear a lot about this strategic industry, strategic goal of increasing industrial capacity in the US. I think there's a reasonable argument to be made there that this is an important policy goal. I think that you would be moving backwards by trying to make this to occur through protectionism. A lot of the reason that industries don't invest and expand in the US here is bad regulations. You have really burdensome environmental regulations. Sometimes you don't have the right skilled labor, right? And so immigration can help as well. I would rather try to grow industrial capacity by moving blockers to industry than by protecting industries from competition. A great example in the onshoring debate is to look at baby formula. Here's an industry that was pre-pandemic produced entirely domestically because of regulation. It's a protectionist success, right? There you go. You've got the protection. The production share of GDP is maximized for this industry, right? And what happened? It became a highly concentrated industry that was extremely fragile. We had one factory shut down, and now you have babies across the country who can't get formula because we have fragility that resulted from specifically protectionism and onshoring. It was so bad that President Biden is flying formula to the US from other countries, right? So this idea that there is a one-to-one relationship between onshoring and fragility and the protectionism is a way to get there, it's in many cases exactly backwards. You know, real imports grew faster in the first few years of the pandemic than real GDP. It turned out our ability to import goods and services was much more flexible and responsive to underlying conditions than our ability to produce our own goods and services. So yeah, I struggle to see this idea that we've learned this simple asymmetric lesson that global supply chains are fragile and thus we must onshore to make our economy more robust and less risky. I think that's completely one-sided. It misses the whole other side of the equation where domestic fragility can occur. Protectionism causes concentration. Concentration makes us dependent on a handful of producers. History is full of lessons like this.
So I see a lot of hands on the panel. Thank you much for that take, Adam. I'm actually going to dive a little bit into this topic regarding trade agreements. And I'm going to pass this to Brent and Jens before I pick on Yuri some more. So Donald Trump recently did state, again, that we all know he'll levy heavy tariffs on both Mexico and Canada. And the Brookings Institution has indicated such broad tariffs could undermine trust in U.S. trade agreements, especially the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. Now, according to the Brookings Institution, 50% of trade between the USMCA participants is driven by integrated supply chains. So, Brent, if you could start us off here, how can or will these tariffs disrupt those chains?
Well, I think it's important. I'll answer that question, but before I'm gonna refer back to what the previous speakers were talking about just for a second, because I think it's important to put this in context. I think for 20, 30, 40 years, we lived in a world where finance people like us could analyze things from an economic and a finance perspective and just think about the numbers from a profitability economic standpoint. I don't think we're in that world anymore. And I think tariffs now are as much about geopolitics, alliances, state necessary projects as opposed to just purely economic ones. And I think that is going to play heavily into who gets tariffs put on them and who won't. So I, in my opinion, Trump, regardless of what anybody else thinks about Trump, Trump sees himself as a deal maker. He would be extremely bored if he put one tariff on for the whole world and then sat back and did nothing. So my guess is he is going to do deals with this country and that country and that country and that country, and it's going to be a bunch of one-off stuff. And when he puts these threats out there for Canada and Mexico, he's not actually thinking about, putting these on Canada and Mexico. But what he's doing, he's anchoring the conversation for another topic, which is U.S. national security regarding its borders. And he's using the economic power of the United States to say, hey, neighbors, you're my friends. We're going to do a lot of business together and we're going to make a lot of money, but you're going to have to help me close down the borders. And by anchoring those conversations right off the bat, before he's even in office, with our two most important trading partners, not only sends a signal to the countries north and south of us, but it sends a message to the rest of the world that literally nobody is safe. So, get on board or get out of the way. And I think it's important to remember that. So I don't think we can just look at this from an economic standpoint anymore. You know, for the 20, 30, 40 years where the world was moving towards one big market, a globalized world, perhaps we could do that. But, unfortunately, the world is fractured now, and the pendulum is starting to swing the other way, and decisions will be made for national security purposes. Decisions will be made for military alliance purposes. Decisions will be made for, domestic needs as opposed to, the perfect price. And I think everybody who thinks about these issues needs to have that framework going forward.
Thank you, Brent. Jens, I want to touch you here for this one as well. Would breaking any trust in trade agreements like the USMCA incentivize other countries to seek partnerships without U.S. involvement? And in other words, could it weaken U.S. influence in regions like Europe, Latin America, and Asia?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Like we're learning, right, that previous agreements don't really mean that much, right? The USMCA was actually negotiated by the Trump administration itself, right? So the idea of putting 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada is not only in conflict with sort of old NAFTA relationships, it's in conflict with the agreement that was signed by Trump himself, right? So all those deals are sort of up in the air, but I think it's worth going back to when you're trying to forecast what's going to happen, which is kind of what we're doing on this call today, right? There's an element, what are these specific tariffs going to do to inflation, growth, and so forth, right? But the first step is to figure out, which tariffs are we actually going to get? Is it going to be 60% on China? Is it going to be 25% on Mexico and Canada? Is it going to be 10% on everything? Those things are totally different. Obviously, we have no chance of getting economic impact correct until we have an idea about which tariffs we're actually going to have, right? And I think as a number of the speakers previously have noted, right, there's very important to separate what are policies, what are threats. Those are different things, right? And if we just go and think about the U.S. versus Canada and Mexico situation, putting 25% on those two close trading partners, allies, you could argue as well, would break a lot of supply chains, cause incredible amount of damage to companies in Texas and Michigan and so forth that rely entirely on those supply chains that would have to be unwound really for no particularly good reason, right? So I don't think those tariffs will happen. It's a threat to make sure that the immigration issue is addressed as quickly as possible, right? In relation to China, it's a totally different thing. There are economic reasons to think that China is an unfair competitor in manufacturing. We need to do something about that. Many people, administration from Scott Bessent to Marco Rubio, right, have sort of strategic geopolitical concerns about China being a big threat to the United States, including militarily, and therefore we need to contain China. So the containment of China is the goal, and the tariff is a part of that mission, right? Not a negotiating tactic. It's not going to be like in 2018 where we tried to have a deal with China where we bought they asked, can you please buy some extra soybeans, as if that was a goal in itself. In respect to China, containment is the goal, and the tariffs very likely will be implemented. There's nothing really that China can give to stop the tariffs. It's quite hard to see what that would be, and it's certainly not going to be a few more soybeans purchased this time around.
Thank you, Jens. I want to touch a little bit more on kind of the domestic side of things here, based on a lot of what was said a little bit closer to the beginning of the panel. Some analysts argue that tariffs in general act as a sort of consumption tax that shifts production, sometimes, maybe even often, inefficiently. Now, although there is some argument that tariffs could temporarily bolster specific industries in the short term, what other consequences, harms, benefits to U.S. productivity could tariffs cause in that long-term scope? Yuri?
Well, that's a really interesting question as well. And just wanted to also make a comment about what's been said in the panel so far. I think it's very interesting that the debate is not really that well formed. It's quite informed by a lot of what existing economic orthodoxy, which is sort of against tariffs. But I think you got to look at the places where there's a bit of a narrative violation of how things maybe were before and how they're maybe changing, but they've already been changing for a long time. So I think the first thing to say is that the US protectionist turn, and this has been documented, took place about 15 years ago. So it precedes the Trump administration, the Biden administration, and all of those areas. I think that that's important because for companies, that's the reality they've had to deal with in terms of new trade regulations put in place by the US. Of course, it's been accelerated by Trump and the Biden administration, which continued a lot of the tariffs as well. I think the second thing is, if you talk to the companies, and I think this is a point that Ben raised before about the sort of uncertainty element, you know, if you talk to the CEOs of organizations that have to make these investment decisions about their manufacturing capacity, sometimes 4 or 5 years in advance, and they're facing this uncertainty that's put potentially these tariffs, that decision used to be a simple one, which was related about costs. I think that decision is very much influenced by risk now. And COVID, despite its obvious big import impulse, actually led to a lot of problems in supply chains, right? Goods couldn't get on time, intermediate goods, final goods, whatever it was. And so if you're an executive at a major corporation, your board probably gave you a pass the first time around, but the second time around, they're not going to do that. And this is just another element of how risky supply chains have become. And so the companies are making these decisions. A lot of government policy is accelerating these things as well. And just one final point on government policy and industrial policy in general. I think it's important to recognize how much industrial policy gets done around the world and how instrumental was the success of the United States to date, and why these policies are almost harking back to the old days of actually having an active industrial policy. And the tariffs, yes, they're a part of this, but you have to remember what's come before it. The companies have been making these decisions. They see a riskier supply chain. You've had three major acts that are investing in U.S. infrastructure and also U.S. industry as well. So there's a subsidization of capacity going in. Some of that will be strategic, but a lot of that is actually also economic, right? That was the approach taken before. Let's subsidize these industries and let them compete globally. So you don't get those situations, as Adam was saying, I believe it was Adam was saying, of these fragile domestic companies. They're actually global champions. And the reality is that this impulse is just going to accelerate under the Trump administration. Now, it'll use a different tool. How that tool plays out, we're often talking about the extremes of that tool, but really it's probably going to be somewhere in the middle. It's going to be that negotiating tool. And so the question then comes back to, well, what happens to US productivity? Well, we all know that productivity in part is driven by investment, and you're already seeing quite a lot of investment going into the US. The US is taking more share of foreign direct investment, partly because even the international companies we talk to, you know, whether it's ABB or car manufacturers, they're thinking, how do I build manufacturing capacity in the US? It's not going to mean moving production from other places. It's probably the incremental manufacturing capacity to de-risk the situation that you face over the next 4 years and beyond. But again, I just go back to where I started by saying this is a lot of this impulse came early, and it's been ingrained already in a lot of the processes going on in the US, and it's just being accelerated by some of these things. And that for us means that it's probably something that's going to be quite have a lot of durability. Everyone here has seen lots of examples of attempts at pushing, you know, reshoring or nearshoring, whatever you call it, in terms of building manufacturing capacity that have just not worked, partly because they've not been coordinated, they've not used the right tools. And just for the first time, if you look back in history, in the last five years, I've really seen a very, very strong push towards industrial policy using all of the tools at the disposal the country can have. But the thing that keeps me bullish about the trend of reshoring is the companies are making these decisions already. It's happening. And these companies see just a lot of risks in global supply chains. And if they can offset some of those risks by investing in domestic manufacturing, that with automation and modern tools can be somewhat competitive versus other areas, other countries in the world, they'll do that. And that's what we're seeing on the ground is happening. And that investment will probably boost some of the productivity that you're seeing.
So you actually touched on something I also wanted to pick your brain about, Yuri, on the investment side of things. You mentioned automation. When we last discussed tariffs together, we touched on the topic of a potential, quote, industrial reshoring revolution, that bringing production and manufacturing to the United States, developing that domestically. Could tariffs actually incentivize automation over job creation, particularly in manufacturing? And if so, how does this shape that narrative of industrial revolution, and how do funds such as TAMA ETFs, RSHO, how do they kind of navigate that and any volatility that kind of comes with it?
Yeah, I mean, day to day, what we're doing is we're talking and looking at companies that are going to benefit or facilitate the reshoring and rebuilding of the US. And a big part of this is automation. Because I think the reality is, and everyone will admit this, is that still to this day, the US in terms of manufacturing costs, if you just look at purely those things, is not that competitive relative to the rest of the world. Once you start looking at layering in automation, and of course also the risks that I mentioned before, it starts to make a more compelling total cost of ownership case. Now, these are really difficult to put together. And again, I always go back to that it's fundamentally, it's businesses making these decisions, and businesses are quite ruthless in terms of their calculus. And automation plays a big part in this, because if you're Stanley Black & Decker, if you're bicycle manufacturer, you're probably gonna build a very highly automated plant in the US. Now, in terms of jobs, the US has ceded so many jobs that even the highly automated plants will require some manufacturing employment, which will lead to some manufacturing employment growth. I mean, literally since China joined WTO, the US has lost something like 4 million manufacturing jobs, quite a substantial part of its manufacturing base, employment base. So we think that some of that will come back, and that's why, to your productivity argument, it's going to be boosted because you're going to have modern automation tools on top of that. And someone made an interesting point about training, and I think these parts are all important externalities of this effect. So if this, the way this is all happens is if businesses actually make these decisions faced with uncertainty, then you're going to see an investment boom in the US, which you're already seeing lots and lots of signs of, and the rebuilding of the US manufacturing base. And just one final point I'll make is a lot of these industries, the ones that we see, are the future-proofed industries in a way. The US is not building a lot of manufacturing capacity in industries that it knows can be produced cheaper elsewhere and aren't competitive in. But it's trying to rebuild semiconductor manufacturing in the US. It's trying to build a lot of electric vehicles and battery production, as well as renewable energy, et cetera, et cetera. And the list goes on. And this is a concerted industrial policy to make sure that the base of manufacturing you're building is future-proofed for what may come in terms of future industries. So you know, we're the companies we speak to are quite optimistic. It's only just begun. You know, Eaton, which is a big supplier of electrical equipment in the US, they reckon that something like 15% of the big projects that have been announced have even started or broken ground. So we're very early in the innings of building this capacity. How this plays out at the economy level, of course, there's a ton of uncertainty, as the other speakers have said, how this plays out long term. But I think regardless, you'll see more and more manufacturing capacity in the US, more investment in the US, and a rebuilding of this manufacturing base with automation at its heart. And I think probably everyone can agree that that's what's going to happen.
And Yuri, I know you have a time constraint here. Before you go, and before I start picking other brains here about policy, what more should people know about TAMA, especially the reshoring ETF? Where can people find more information about that?
Well, Nicholas, first of all, thanks a lot for having me on. And yes, I've got to jump to another webinar. I've got a couple more minutes, but I think the what I would say is, if you're thinking about the world as a maybe a less safe place than it was even 15 years ago in terms of the risks to supply chains, and by the way, they're not just trade policy risks, whether it's the attacks in the Red Sea, the drought in the Panama Canal, port strikes. I think if you have a supply chain that stretches 7,000 kilometers and takes weeks to arrive into the US, as a business and a consumer, it's difficult to see how that fragility and that uncertainty gets repaired. And so if you think that the world is going that direction and you see some of these indicators, what we look at is what the reshoring fund looks at is companies that are essentially gaining an advantage by moving manufacturing to the US, but also the companies that are facilitating the rebuilding of US manufacturing base, whether it's aggregates companies, inspection companies, a lot of under the radar types of businesses. And these companies are the ones that are at stage one of the reshoring boom. And then you also have the broad beneficiaries that will benefit if once that industrial production rate starts to go up. And as we know, the stock market isn't great at pricing this sort of structural change in. A lot of industrial companies are often traded at very low multiples because they're perceived as cyclical. As I said, industrial production hasn't structurally grown in 20, 25 years. If that starts to change, we could see a drastic repricing in some of these areas, and that's what the fund is focused on investing in. We've got an industrials expert that manages the fund. He's been doing this for 25, 30 years, seen lots of economic cycles and lots of policy come and go, which I'm sure you'll discuss in detail after I leave the spaces. But that's really the core of the fund and its focus. So for investors who are looking for a way of getting access to this type of growth, that we think is priced very attractively in the market, even with the retirement of the risk of the Trump administration and the positive effects it has, that I think is, the reshoring fund is an interesting potential add to their portfolios. Of course, with the caveat that it should fit your risk and return profiles and to speak to your financial advisor about it as well.
Beautifully said, Yuri. And folks, if you want more information on TAMA's reshoring ETF, pinned right at the top of the space here is an article on TAMA ETF's website. Definitely a lot of great information in there about the supply chain, manufacturing, security, etc. So definitely check that out. So what I want to touch on here that's been mentioned several times now by several speakers, and Yuri touched on it very briefly, is that of policies surrounding tariffs and trade, etc. But I want to touch on a different aspect of policy here and the effects that might be had. And that's the policy of the Federal Reserve. Specifically, how might the Federal Reserve respond to tariff-induced inflation should they prove inflationary? Could this create issues between U.S. monetary policy and U.S. trade policy. I want to start with Boris here and kick it around the panel.
Yeah, sure. I think it will probably depend now going from kind of the broad discussions to the specificity of policy. I think it will depend on the rollout of the tariffs and how they're implemented. I know there's a lot of uncertainty about the extent of the tariffs, but I think I would be very surprised if we get a broad flat tax on our tariff on the rest of the world. Because if you look at the first trade war between China and the US under Trump, a lesser known aspect of it was that the tariffs were chosen in a really strategic way, meaning the tariffs were primarily focused on intermediate and capital goods. And this was basically to minimize the impact on inflation and GDP. And the Fed also had a paper out in 2017 talking about these potential tariffs. And they said that if this tariff war continues into the consumer goods side, then this would be, of course, inflationary. So as a base case, and this is why I think most think tanks see this and most investment banks, is that as a base case, if we don't get the flat tariff tax, if we focus on specific selected tariffs, which I think is plausible given kind of the early staffing pattern of Trump and making Kevin Hassett his chair of the National Economic Council, which of course was also a person that was heavily invested in compiling the initial tariff list under Trump trade war 1.0. I think it's really reasonable to say that we'll probably get the main brunt of the tariff on China, which probably will jump from around 12 to 13% now to probably more about 30%. And the second point is that the first rollout of the tariffs would largely be focused on capital goods and intermediate goods. And so it will, in the short term, dampen the effect on inflation. I think one point that was mentioned, though, is the externality of it, because we're always talking about the import side or importing companies, but the exporting side is also important as well. And if you raise tariffs on intermediate goods, which are basically used by every exporter, this, I think, could in the long term, dependent on the extent of the increase, also have inflationary impacts. But I think it's important to preface that all depends on the rollout and the actual extent of the tariffs being discussed.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an incredibly important aspect of the whole, potentially trade wars or tariffs, however we want to define this issue. And that is that if these tariffs come into being, in many ways, they can be an equivalent of a rate hike. And so it very much plays into what the Fed is trying to accomplish. If they are trying to ease policy because they think the economy or the rates are too restrictive, at the same time that Trump is putting on tariffs, which is causing certain prices to rise and is causing certain economic ratios to decline, they can in many ways be at odds with each other. One thing I would say, though, is as these tariffs get put on, the speed with which and the degree to which they get put on will also greatly affect the currency markets, in my opinion. All things equal, I think tariffs are positive impact for the dollar. And so as the dollar strengthens, it has the potential, and listen, there's no guarantee, but it has the potential to help offset some of the rise in prices. And if the dollar is increasing in purchasing power and we start manufacturing more stuff here in the United States than we have historically, but because it's more expensive to do it here, the fact that the dollar is stronger can help offset some of that. And you have to remember, if this happens, as this is happening, it means other countries' currencies are falling, and it means their economies are under pressure from the effects of a stronger dollar. And if you have any doubts that this is the case, just go back and look at 2022 and look what happened all over the world in 2022. In fact, just go back the last couple months. Look what's been going on in China. Look what's been going on in Korea. Look what's been going on in Syria. Look what's been going on, all over the world. It's not a coincidence that things are starting to break as the dollar is at a two-year high. And it's because the system just isn't designed for a stronger dollar. So if these trade negotiations and these tariff negotiations are taking place at a time when the dollar is stronger versus foreign currencies, that means these other countries are going to be under pressure. And if the other countries are under pressure, it's going to give Trump more leverage in whatever deal he extracts. And then the last thing I'll say on this, and then I'll hand it back, is that potentially what they're going to do, and this would potentially help offset any conflict that there was with the Fed, is that they could say, listen, these tariffs are going into effect 12 months from now, 18 months from now. You've got 18 months to get your house in order, to get your things figured out, but then the tariffs are coming on, right? And if you think about what else happens, you know, 18 months, 2 years from now, is about the time that I think Powell's chairmanship expires. And then Trump can put somebody in at the same time that these tariffs are going on. Trump can put his own guy in there ahead of the Fed and who's, you know, friendly with Besant. Or, and, you know, now all of a sudden they've got everything working together. So I think in the short term, there's potential for conflict. And that's why I kind of said at the very beginning, there is going to be volatility initially. But it doesn't mean that it means volatility has to last forever. So I'll pass it back at this point.
Great points there, Brent. Thank you. Adam, you had comments there as well?
Yeah, I think that the bet on volatility is a good one. If I can throw some stock market thoughts out. I know this is a chat for stock guys, so I want to throw some stock things out at you guys. I think that if you look at the first 2 years of the first Trump administration, volatility was declining, right? Because Trump wasn't doing anything shocking. He wasn't doing anything that was really disturbing to the economy in a major way. But then 2018, you saw a huge surge in the VIX just as Trump began to pursue his protectionist agenda, began to put tariffs in place. And, you know, the conflict with the Fed started to heat up. So I think that if he comes right out the gate with the trade war, as everyone here has acknowledged, it's a tremendous amount of certainty created by that. I think that would be pro-volatility. In terms of whether tariffs would constitute effectively an interest rate hike that would allow the Fed to be more dovish, I really don't think this is the case. As one of the other speakers has noted, Trump tariffs were very, quote, strategic in the sense that they targeted intermediary and capital goods. That is a true description of what they did. They targeted a lot of intermediary and capital goods, but that's a hilarious use of the term strategic, because this is, you know, damaging to our exporters, damaging to our manufacturing base. So it's maybe strategic in the sense of like trying to hide the ball from consumers. But when you have a, you know, fast moving tax on manufacturers' inputs, that can very easily manifest itself as a supply shock. So if I'm a manufacturer and I get important equipment or inputs from China and this tariff goes into place, firms may respond by, rather than rewriting all of their contracts and finding new suppliers, by simply waiting to expand to increase demand, by pulling back production in some ways. So it's very easy for a manufacturing input focused tariff to function as a supply shock, which obviously is not deflationary. And so, yes, is a tariff a tax? Yes. Ceteris paribus, would a tax like reduce inflationary pressures? Yes. But you have to consider the impact on supply curves and production as well.
Thank you, Adam. So I want to touch a little bit on the potential for revenue that some critics have posited in support of tariffs and in, you know, as a detractor of tariffs. So in the topic of revenue redistribution, according to the Peterson Institute, Trump's proposed tariffs could generate significant revenue, potentially funding income tax cuts, which Trump has obviously continuously indicated he plans to somehow eradicate altogether. However, critics argue this disproportionately benefits wealthier households while increasing the financial burden on lower income citizens. And so I'm kind of curious on your take here. Let's start with Boris, and I want to kick this one around the panel, so feel free to chime in.
Yeah, sounds good. I think it really depends, again, on the extent of the tariffs, of how much of the budget hole coming from the extension of the TCJA can be filled by the tariffs. I think if you look at, for example, the Bloomberg Economics baseline, which I think is currently the most plausible, is you get an increase, the doubling of the tariff on China, you get a 3-5% flat tax on the rest of the world on intermediate goods only. And this would spark around $250 billion of additional tariff revenue. So if you look at how much the extension of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act would cost, it would be around $500 billion in additional revenue, which would start once it gets extended starting in 2026. So if you have these kind of, I would say, for Trump favorable assumptions, you would only feel half of the whole. And I think this also raises a really good point. We have been talking about nearshoring as one, I would say, benefit to the tariff discussion. But I think if you hadn't had such a hole to fill on the budget side, I think Trump wouldn't be talking too much about the tariffs. So I think, in my opinion, the tariffs are, of course, have to do with the attempt of Trump to nearshore or onshore some of the manufacturing production and bring the manufacturing base back to the US. But the second point that is also critical and can't be left unsaid is that the effect of increasing tariffs is there to fill some of the budget holes that come from extending some of the tax cuts and, of course, some of the plans to expand industrial production into the US. So I think this is an important point to raise here.
So the other thing I wanted to touch on here is that of businesses that manufacture here in the United States, but importing the raw materials or the goods they need to manufacture. Countless small businesses and consumers in the United States that do rely heavily on affordable imports. And so I'm curious your thoughts here, Andy. How might these tariffs affect pricing and accessibility of goods for the smaller guys?
I don't know if that's my lane. My only comment would be it's still going to be about uncertainty. To the extent that tariffs generate a temporary supply chain disruption, the ones that are going to feel that are the ones that are most sensitive to just-in-time manufacturing. And certainly retailers in particular might find their shelves being bare when they need it. So I would say it's mostly an uncertainty thing, and I could imagine where it falls more heavily on businesses that are distributors, so to speak.
You know, I'd echo Andy's thoughts that this isn't my necessarily my lane, but I think the overall point I would make with regard to this specific question is that this is not going to be easy. Again, this is as I said at the beginning, this is revolutionary, and desperation is the mother, or necessity is the mother of all invention, right? And unfortunately, some companies are going to be hurt. I mean, that's just the way it is. This is not going to be a smooth transition. But if we want to be a country that, makes its own stuff again and isn't reliant on a quote-unquote enemy for its vital goods, it's something that we have to figure out. And to the extent that, Trump can put some policies in place to help soften the blow and that we can get some revenue from other countries in the form of tariffs and then pass those revenues on to the companies that are struggling in the form of tax breaks, maybe 3, 4, 5 years down the road, we're kind of on the way. But it's going to be a tough transition. I don't want anybody to think that just because Trump says everything's going to be fantastic, that it means it's going to be that way day one. I think he knows himself that this is going to be a tough deal, but he's kind of committed to doing it.
I have a thought about the impact of this on small businesses. I think that one of the most interesting ways that tariffs are problematic, and that's ignored often by advocates, is it's a huge corruption issue. When you create this policy, which then you allow individual companies to get exemptions for, and there were thousands of exemptions filed with the USTR to get out of Trump's tariffs. And what research showed was that those companies who were most politically connected were the ones who got exempted from tariffs. This is not something that the people who think tariffs are some genius strategy for revitalizing the industrial base usually tend to consider, which is that it lends itself to crony capitalism, where politically connected companies, who, by the way, are going to tend to be those large companies. It's not going to be the small businesses. It's not going to be a small manufacturer in the heartland who's making some widget, who's going to get an exemption from steel tariffs. It's going to be huge corporations. And so I think that, you know, that's an important part of it. It's not that this is worse for small business, is not the most economically damaging part of it, but I think it does really illustrate the way that these this policy isn't strategic. It's arbitrary. You know, what are we trying to get out of this? What you found was that when Trump negotiated with China, half of what he asked for was agricultural and energy imports. So, like, there's nothing strategic about more soybean production or sending liquefied natural gas and coal to China. We I keep hearing this refrain of, well, this is for negotiation, strategic negotiation, negotiation. I'd love to see some evidence of strategic negotiation. Instead, what I see is we have this huge, risky process of renegotiating NAFTA. And what we end up doing is demanding that Mexican car makers raise their wages. I'm sorry, how's that in the strategic interest of the United States? It simply isn't. This is a Mott and Bailey where people act like it's high-level strategy negotiations going on, but what ends up happening is extremely crude and asks that don't really serve America's best interest. The strategic move was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This was a strategic trade bill that would have focused on securing intellectual property rights and forcing China to be a better global global country in terms of following trade rules and respecting intellectual property. That's the big brain strategy move. Getting China to promise and then not actually import more soybeans. There's no strategy there. It's not helpful to us. It doesn't further our national interests. It does nothing for industrialization. So we need more realism about what trade protectionism negotiations in practice are looking like.
Hey, this is Brent. I just wanted to jump in and say that is an absolutely excellent point. And I kind of wish I would have brought it up because it's such a good one. I mean, the potential for corruption in these types of programs is, as the speaker said, you know, tremendous. And the fact that the big multinational companies are probably going to be the ones that get the exemptions over the small mom and pop in, you know, Nebraska or Tennessee is likely true. And so that, I think that's probably something to keep in mind as you allocate assets. But it is a very big problem, and it's a point very well made.
And like the 2018 tariffs, I know farmers took a huge hit. I grew up in Iowa, and a lot of family members, extended friends and stuff worked in farming and took a hit there too. So there's a lot of factors going on, and a lot of companies, a lot of sectors that could be benefited and, you know, hurt pretty bad by certain policies. So what I want to do here before we send folks off into the ether of their afternoons is just kind of kick around the panel any closing thoughts you may have, anything you wanted to touch on, and anything you want to plug. So let's go ahead and start with Andy here, and then we'll go through Brent, Adam, and Ben, and Boris for any closing thoughts before we send people off.
Sure. Well, number one, thanks for having me, and I can be found at dampspring.com or twograybeards.com or here on Twitter. I appreciate all the panelists. I think that the big takeaway should be that there's a fair degree of uncertainty, but the direction is clear. We're going into a period of time in which there is going to be quite a bit of frictions in trade, and a goal that may or may not grow the GDP of the country, but in the short term, may cause the costs for goods for consumers to rise while also resulting in more business for U.S. companies. But there is something about the last 40 years that feels unequal. And I think it's probably, as Brent said, it's probably a good outcome that the U.S. takes a leadership role in setting up the way trade will be done in the future.
Okay, so this is Brent, so I'll go next. I just want to say thanks for the host for inviting me. I actually think this is the most important issue out there right now. Again, to echo Andy's comments, this is happening. Whether you think it's happen or should happen, or whether it shouldn't happen, whether you think it's good or bad, it's happening, and I think it's only I don't think it's going to go slow either. I think it's going to go relatively fast. For anybody who you know, liked some of the stuff that I had to say, I've got a company called Santiago Capital, which is a wealth management firm. But I also do a weekly show called Milkshakes, Markets, and Madness. And we just started a research service about 6 months ago called Macro Alchemist. If you go to macroalchemist.com, you can download all of our reports. The last two reports that we have put out are on this exact issue. In fact, I think one of them was called Trump Trade and Tariffs. So I think it is probably the most important issue for investors and asset allocators to get their arms around. And you know, I'll leave it at that. But thanks again for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity to share my ideas.
Thanks for coming and sharing, Brent. Boris, any closing thoughts? Anything to plug?
Yeah, sure. So I think my kind of closing remarks would be what we say to clients at the beginning of every client meeting in Europe and the US, namely that it is true that the macro landscape is clearly becoming much more complex and has been over the last couple of decades. And this is, of course, a function of the economy in and of itself becoming more complex. But I think also because the government is starting to impose itself again into economic life, be it via industrial policies or via tariffs and these tax cuts. And you can clearly see this by the increase of uncertainty and volatility, not only in the trade space, but also geopolitics. So two stats we always give clients on their way is that the number of conflicts around the world is currently at an all-time high at 56. And the second one is that every single year since 2021, around 2,000 new industrial policies are implemented globally, which is 10 times the number of the mid-2010s. So clearly something has changed, as most speakers have said. And it is important to understand that this change will not be short-term. It's something that is longer lasting. And this is why we are seeing these frictions on the trade front. And this is what we do for our clients. We analyze the markets and the macroeconomy. And if you like what we have said, then you can subscribe to me on LinkedIn and or Twitter. Thanks.
Adam, anything to add here at the tail end? Anything you need to plug?
Yeah, so great discussion. Thanks everyone for coming. Thanks for having me. I think that we need to keep a couple things in mind. There's obviously a great deal of excitement in many corners about the U.S. federal government turning more towards industrial policy and protectionism. I think it's important to not just focus on the handful of case studies in history where industrial policy and protectionism may have played a role in revitalizing or creating an industry in some country, and understand that there is a long, long track record of failure. We have done industrial policy in this country for a long time. We've tried to stimulate the domestic steel industry, and it's gone terribly. We have tried to, via protectionism, stimulate the domestic shipbuilding industry. It has gone terribly. And countries all over the world have tried to create their own domestic auto industries. There's nothing new under the sun here. None of this is new. Everything from the policies to the corruption of those policies, nothing here is new. I think it's important to focus on the areas where it's gone best, like the CHIPS Act, which is a really smart policy aimed at a genuinely strategic industry, and be very critical of the areas where it's not going great, which is, you know, the tariffs are among the worst in terms of the impacts that we've seen. Industrial policy is difficult. It is very hard. And if we lower the bar to celebrate crude protectionism that's counterproductive, we're going to end up failing, as many, many countries have before.
Thank you much, Adam, and thank you for coming. Professor Ben, take us home.
I just want to jump in. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Really lots of smart takes, and I appreciate it. I want to just kind of amplify, maybe it's not surprising that Adam and I are kind of on the same team. I think a lot of the discussions of reshoring and comparisons with industrial policy in the past can be very naive in the present context. Like even the idea that reshoring is known to achieve what it aims to achieve, which is to bring some of that fragility kind of out of the supply chain, is just not clear at all that's what it's going to do, because these supply chains, whatever it is we do, they're going to span continents and involve multiple ship trips across oceans in the production of a typical good. Can you move all the complexity to the links that you control and for some reason that you think are robust, you know, good luck. If you, I think there are cases, and I think the CHIPS Act is a good one, where the consensus among, even among people who were very engaged with the complexity of that industry, was that it would, you know, is that it would work, and there was a lot of consensus. But overall, I'm reminded of something I was told by someone very senior at the IMF, that there's just very little evidence that countries know what they're doing when they're reshoring. There's a lot of special pleading. And so I'm kind of surprised, honestly, from a finance, from a group of finance people to be sort of very trusting of government's wisdom in doing this correctly. I think there's complexities here that are genuinely unprecedented in how much supply chains have evolved since the kind of analogies people are drawing. And so I think caution and an understanding of the uncertainty has to be central to thinking about this seriously from an economic policy perspective.
Great points there, Ben. And thanks for coming in kind of last second. I know you kind of didn't get a ton of prep time to join us today, but having your ancillary takes was really useful today. So thank you for coming in. Everybody, if you're not following the speakers we had today, do that. They are constantly posting information, education, and tracking policies as they come up. So you're going to get a lot from following these folks. And of course, keep an eye on our sponsor today, Tama ETFs. They have a lot of funds under management. They've been doing a lot of spaces with us. And every time we have a Tama ETF space, the information is invaluable. I learn a lot on these. And the speakers we've been having just make my job really easy as a host with their takes, their information. Keep an eye out on the Unusual Whales page for upcoming panels. We'll have one on FOMC later this month. We have a couple lined up for January as well. As always, thanks for coming, everybody. Hopefully you learned a lot today, and you have a great rest of your afternoon. Thanks, everybody.